It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Sunday, March 19th, 2023. I'm Chad Pergram. As the Fed continues its fight against inflation, little progress has been made between the President and Congress in their efforts to avoid a debt crisis.
There is a debt problem that's sort of brewing, and the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, you know, basically said, hey, we've got to deal with this because it will be the number one issue in the future, and the future is now not that far away.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. The president backtracks on a promise that there will be no new oil drilling on public land with the approval of Alaska's Willow Project, sparking new lawsuits from environmentalists, but support from some Republicans.
It shows you just how important this project is, not just for Alaska, but for America. 2,500 direct jobs. The indirect jobs are probably, you know, much, much greater than that.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. Joining me today is my colleague from Fox Business, White House correspondent Edward Lawrence. So, Edward, talk to us about the president's budget proposal. He put that out this past week. And I always like to remind people, you know, that budgets are not binding. This is simply an aspirational document. But people really get a sense of where the president and where the administration's spending and policy goals are from a budget.
Exactly. And this was a wish list from the president, which we see from all presidents. And you know, it goes through a process now where they're going to have to try and whittle it down, go back and forth. But, you know, I heard the House Finance or Budget Committee chairman saying that now they're behind because the president's budget was 4 weeks late coming in. So now they're behind trying to get their stuff done and they're scrambling to go through it, as you know.
And of course, you know, we've heard that the Republicans might have trouble getting their budget together. Do you view what they're saying there as an excuse, or does it actually kind of help them, or at least give them a public way to say, look, you know, because the president was so far behind, we're behind now, too, because they weren't exactly Johnny on the spot getting their budget together, frankly, on the Republican side in the House.
Exactly. And as you know, historically, that has been an issue for both parties in getting budgets in on time. This president has actually missed every single budget he has put in. He's missed the deadline for him. This is actually cover. It's also cover for the Republicans going forward, trying to get that budget together. But, you know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done with the budget. So they're going through line item, trying to make sure what they want, they see what the president wants. Trying to fit these together is going to be the difficult part, is where the sauce is made. Because, you know, at the moment, you know, both sides really aren't talking together. They're talking amongst themselves and at each other. We hear the president say in his speeches talking about the Republicans, show me your budget, show me your budget. So they're sort of talking at each other right now. The negotiations in earnest haven't really started yet.
And you know, the other thing about these budgets is that they're really, you know, a political weapon. The idea that when you do put a budget out, which is what the president did, I have never in my nearly 30 years in Washington seen a party of the opposite of the president get the budget and not say the following words: debt on arrival. That happened with the Democrats when Republicans were in the White House, vice versa, which might speak to why this is such a fruitless exercise, because budgets have only been around since the adoption of the Budget Act of 1974. It was a way for Congress to try to claw back some of their spending authority, to require the president to kind of get on the record to say, okay, here's what I intend to spend. This is what my request is. But what has happened over the years is the party on Capitol Hill that is opposite the president uses this to criticize that it's too much spending, it's too many taxes, whatever. Right. Or they try to get the other side to take votes here on Capitol Hill and get them on the record to take questionable votes, which they use against them in the election. Talk about that.
Right. Well, and I also think that this budget is particularly important because of the situation that we're in financially. You know, we've got a record amount of debt, federal debt in the United States, $31.5 trillion. And the president's budget, as it lays out, actually increases that debt. Yeah, the deficits each year will come down a little bit, but that deficit spending still continues. The overall end number by 2033 is going to be something like $46 trillion. So there is a debt problem that's sort of brewing, and the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, you know, basically said, hey, we've got to deal with this because it will be the number one issue in the future, and the future is now not that far away. So it's going to be very interesting as they get down to how this budget process works out. And each side, you know, obviously the Democrats and the president wants to keep spending. Republicans would like to cut spending. But the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget says you can't just do one or the other. It's going to have to be a combination of raising taxes and cutting spending in order to get the fiscal responsibility that everybody talks about actually on the books.
And even though we don't have a budget from the House Republicans yet, you know, we kind of get a sense of some of the things that they push for. Oh, we want to balance the budget in 10 years. And there's been some of these outside groups who have said this is economically impossible. Just the level of spending that you would have to cut and what that would do probably to upend the American economy, cut jobs, throw the country into a depression, frankly. I mean, just the amount of people who'd be thrown off of health care programs. And I mean, it's yeah. I mean, this kind of speaks to just how wide ranging the federal government is, because, you know, you would have to cut $7 trillion right away. That's the same as cutting almost 1 year of all federal spending, entitlements and what we call discretionary spending here on Capitol Hill. Talk about that, because Republicans obviously push this, but most people don't understand the math, the, you know, back of the napkin math. And in fact, you probably need probably an entire bounty roll sheet to go through the math on this one, because it's so complicated.
Well, and we did not get here overnight, and that's the big issue here. And the numbers we're talking about are so massive that you just can't fix this in 10 years. It can be fixable in the longer term, but when I've talked with economists and I've talked to people that look at this budget and look at the numbers and where we are and where we need to go, and there really has to be some buckling down and tough decisions, which it seems lawmakers on both sides of the aisle don't have appetite for, but there needs to be that buckling down is what I'm hearing about, you know, going forward and making necessary cuts in certain areas in order to keep services going, yet try and work on the deficit. Because when you talk about the interest that we pay on the debt, it's going to be the number one, it is actually right now the fastest growing government expenditure, but it will be the number one expenditure, you know, at some point out in the future. And again, that future is closer than we think when you look at some of these projections. So that is going to be a very difficult thing going forward.
Let me take everybody down the rabbit hole a little bit. So imagine you have a pie, and the pie, you have two pies, really. The first pie kind of tells you everything that the government spends. And I think this budget proposal by the president for everything that the federal government spend would be $6 trillion in change is what it is. So if you take about 30% of that pie and move that over to another pie, make it, it's a full pie, but just take 30% out. So back with the first pie, 70%, that is what we call entitlement spending and debt service that Edward alludes to here, meaning that Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, that gets you up into about the 64-65% of that pie. And then you're a little bit over 5-6% on debt service, which, by the way, has gotten more expensive because why? Interest rates have gone up in the past year and change. So that is a growing area of the budget. And so if you were going to cut, you would obviously want to cut from the biggest area, and that would be entitlements, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and you see how that would wound the economy. That's why that's so dangerous.
And politically, that is something that you just can't do. Social Security and Medicare, you saw what happened in the State of the Union address. Voters just don't have an appetite for cutting any of those benefits. And what you look for when you're talking about the economy moving forward, you're also looking to the debt to GDP ratio. And the president's budget through 2033, the increase of debt to GDP ratio goes from 98% today to 110% by 2033. And when you get over 100%, that's not sustainable for a growing economy. That would tend to put a huge drag on being able to do more business and get business done in the United States because of those debt payments that we've been talking about.
And Edward, what seems to be kind of left out of this discussion about the president's budget right now is the debt ceiling. I mean, Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, alluded to this at her hearing on Capitol Hill before the Senate Finance Committee the other day. Ron Wyden, the chair of the committee, the Democrat from Oregon, He talked about that a little bit, saying, you know, you really want to, you know, make sure that there is stability in the markets, because there's been that volatility because of what's happened with the banks the past few days. You want to raise the debt ceiling and make sure that the United States government is paying its bills. That has been absent as this part of the conversation. And that's where some people are saying it's a good thing there doesn't seem to be a contagion yet with the banks. But that is something that the administration is looking closely at, is the, you know, the fiscal, you know, nature of these banks.
Well, and I can tell you that I talked with a number of CEOs, this was, I guess, about a month ago, from mid to large size companies. I was in a room with a number of them, and a lot of them had government contracts, and they were all planning now for a 2 to 2.5 month shutdown of the government, either A, through the debt ceiling issue, or B, at the end of the year when they talk about this budget that they're going to try and get done. So obviously, corporate America thinks that there's going to be an issue at some point this year when it comes to government spending and getting things done with the government. So having said that, yeah, it's going to be a very interesting trying to get all of this done. When you talk about the debt ceiling, you know, we're looking at a shorter timeline. You've got maybe to June is the earliest we've heard the estimates, through September is when the government will actually hit that debt ceiling and won't be able to pay its bills. Now, we've heard from both sides of the aisle, as you know, that they say that the U.S. will not default on its debt. It's never happened. We've gotten close a couple of times, but it's never happened where we've defaulted on our debt. So the Republicans would like the president to come to the table and say, yes, we're going to work on some spending cuts going forward in exchange for getting this debt ceiling number to be increased. And, you know, I heard Representative Buddy Carter say that, you know, no one really talks about spending in earnest until the debt ceiling is almost reached. And that's an issue. And then you mentioned the banks. When you throw this all in there, you know, that is a huge issue, because you have an underlying weakness now that's being shown in the community banks because of the interest rate hikes for the Federal Reserve. So all of this is tied in together. If we get close to that debt service ceiling, that debt ceiling where we won't be able to pay our debt anymore, you know, it could affect bond ratings. It could affect how the world views the U.S. economy going forward, because you get close to that deadline, people get nervous. The investors get nervous, and it costs more money than if any of our bond ratings are affected. But then you have that underlying weakness in the community banks that I talked about. You know, we had two banks that have failed already. First Republic Bank is another one that's being bailed out by the industry itself. They've put $30 billion now into that bank to stabilize it. And we've also learned that all of the large banks have now borrowed $153 billion from the Federal Reserve discount window just this week alone, because they're trying to shore up their reserves about a run on money. And that's what they're worried about, consumer confidence and a run on money. When you put all of this together, you know, you have the debt ceiling coming up in June. You've got a little bit of instability right now. That could be very, very bad if the right decisions are not made.
Yeah, that's a bad intersection of a lot of things going on there if that happens. And I think that's why some are concerned about the banks when there isn't an obvious solution to deal with the debt ceiling right now. And to be clear, you know, you talked about a government shutdown. That would not happen until the end of September. But there's really yes. only two big votes that Congress has to worry about in the next couple of months here. Number one is lifting the debt ceiling, which would come in the summer, as you say, and then funding the government. And the question is, what is the matrix of votes in the House of Representatives to be able to move either of those things, and can they get that through the Senate? That is a real challenge. And the other thing that strikes me in this too is when you have these institutions that have had issues, you know, because again of interest rates, and Republicans were happy to point this out at the hearing with Janet Yellen. You had obviously Silicon Valley Bank, that they were heavily invested in treasuries, and some of these other institutions have been as well. Well, if you are having to, you know, sell those treasuries short and not get them to full maturity, those banks are going to lose money because they got to pay yes. their customers who come to the window and say, I want my money. And that's what happened here. That's a consequence
yeah,
of higher interest rates.
It wasn't. It was not a reserve problem. It was a liquidity problem. So the
right.
banks invested, this specifically Silicon Valley Bank, invested in long-term treasuries that they thought they had 10 years or so in order to have that money on hand. What happened is, as through the internet, through however it happened, word of mouth, there was a run on deposits, and a significant run, as it's being described as, on deposits. We're talking billions of dollars trying to get out of that bank. And so they needed to quickly come up with that money for those depositors. And then that's what forced the failing of that bank, because they made a bet, a little risky bet on long-term treasuries. So they actually had the money. It's just they couldn't access the money.
Yeah. And is this going to influence Jerome Powell, you know, when he testified just a week ago? Imagine if Jerome Powell testified this past week, what the questions would have been like to him. He was up here. But, you know, he indicated at that testimony before the Senate that he was going to raise interest rates again. Didn't say exactly how much, but everybody's kind of, you know, thinking this 5.5 to 5.75% percent here. But because we've had this recalibration with the banks, will that impact his thinking?
We were talking about a half a percentage point in interest rate hikes. That's a more aggressive rate hike. That is off the table now, according to the markets. When you look at CME Fred Watch, they keep a running tab of where the markets believe the rate hikes will be. Now, we don't know what happens until that meeting happens on Wednesday. But, you know, 50 basis points was on the table, and it looked like that's what the Fed was going to do. Now, because of the banking instability, it looks like we're looking at a 25 basis points. They're going to cut that in half, a quarter of a percentage point increase in interest rates. So it's already had an effect on the will of the market, which sort of will push the Federal Reserve in that direction. You know, the Fed's in a tough spot because you've still got inflation at 6%, which is three times more than what the Federal Reserve would like. So they have an inflation problem, but now you have cracks showing in the banking system because of the rate hikes that are happening. So they're in a tricky spot here. So it does look like we're going to get a rate hike, probably now a quarter of a point, not a half a percentage point. But if you talk to some economists, they would say the Fed has to go the half a percentage point in order to get inflation where they need it to go this year. Because right now what we're seeing in the month over month trends is inflation is actually staying the same or actually rising in the core inflation. That's without food and energy prices. And that core inflation is sticky inflation, hard to get rid of, and really concerns the Fed chairman. So they want to be more aggressive, but might not be able to be more aggressive because of what happens with the banks.
I want to end on the debt ceiling, and in a way that a lot of people might not put together here. But, you know, on Friday, we had a meeting at the Capitol with the President of the United States and the Speaker of the House. Now, they last got together, the last time they did a meeting, was down at the White House about 7 weeks ago. It was their first meeting since Kevin McCarthy had become the Speaker. And they talked about the debt ceiling. They didn't really lay out any concrete proposals. McCarthy left that meeting a little ebullient, frankly, saying, you know, if I was the markets, I would be less concerned than maybe, you know, when I went into this meeting here. Nothing in Washington gets solved until it absolutely has to get solved. Okay, so that's why we're probably talking June, July here on this issue. But they are meeting at the Capitol with the Irish Prime Minister. And this happens every single year, usually around St. Patrick's Day. It's called the Friends of Ireland Lunch. And the government of Ireland is the only government on the planet that every year has a guaranteed meeting with the President of the United States and the Speaker of the House. And so that's really a lot about trade, frankly. Yes, they talk about shamrocks and Guinness and cabbage and all that, but that's really a lot of other things here. But, you know, this is the first meeting that McCarthy and President Biden have had since that debt ceiling meeting. They've gone radio silent since then, and nothing really, you know, coming out of that meeting either to solve the debt ceiling. So do people start to say, wait a minute, at what point are these guys going to get serious?
And I think that conversation or the grumblings have already started, because you're looking at June at the earliest. That is not far away when you're talking about Congress and you're talking about lawmakers. And so I think that you're starting to hear or starting to feel some nerves under the surface a little bit. You know, here at the White House, when I've talked to some folks off the sidelines, and there is a little bit of concern that this process hasn't moved a little faster, because there's going to be very hard conversations as both sides with the debt ceiling are very dug in to where they believe they need to be. The White House, the president, will not negotiate negotiate anything else over the debt ceiling. They're saying just raise the debt ceiling to where we need it and let's pick a number. Whereas Kevin McCarthy, as you know, is saying we need to negotiate on some other things about spending to get more fiscally responsible, and then we'll talk about where that debt ceiling number should be.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting that you're hearing that, but this is starting to, you know, make people rattled a little bit, because historically in the past several years, when we've had a government shutdown or we've had, you know, kind of a dance with death with the debt ceiling, Wall Street and investors and the markets and, you know, business leaders have kind of ignored this as just political theater in Washington. And generally it has been. Now, it was a little bit different in 2011, the last time Right. we really had this debt ceiling crisis. It was certainly different in 08 when you had, you know, the fiscal instability, which led to the Great Recession. And, you know, they struggled to pass the TARP bill, you know, the financial rescue package for troubled Yep. assets relief program, TARP. TARP was the abbreviation there. But, you know, they have generally not been spooked. But you're saying that they're getting spooked now, and that's very interesting.
There's some nerves. You're starting to hear some, hey, these conversations need to start happening.
Very good. Well, Edward, good to talk with you, and I'm sure we'll do this again soon.
Thanks, Chad.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. January 26th, 1988 was a cold and suspiciously quiet night at the Indianapolis Police Department, but the frigid night took a chilling turn with news of a triple homicide. This week, I'm joined by retired Sergeant Judd Green for a look back at this savage case. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and foxnewspodcast.com.
This past week, the Biden administration officially approved the Willow Project, an oil drilling plan for Alaska's North Slope in the National Petroleum Reserve. This despite the president's promises on the campaign trail, like this moment in a CNN debate in 2020.
No more drilling on federal lands, no more drilling, including offshore, no ability for the oil industry to continue to drill, period, ends.
At the time, his campaign said this meant no new drilling on public lands. And now with this approval, some in his administration are noting that ConocoPhillips had these lease rights for some time. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland said in a video,
"These are existing leases issued by previous administrations as far back as the 90s. As a result, we had limited decision space, but we focused on how to reduce the project's footprint and minimize its impacts to people and to wildlife."
And despite these leaseholds, there have been lawsuits. 2 years ago, a federal judge sided with environmental groups, finding the Bureau of Land Management's environmental review was insufficient. Now additional groups are suing, including Earth Justice, along with the Trustees for Alaska, which includes three Alaska-based environmental groups. One of the Native officials opposing the project, Nooksut Mayor Rosemary Attengrook, was featured in Native Movement's recent videos about the Willow Project.
Prudhoe Bay, Ulikdorp, the development at Alpine, and then the development with the Willow Project. All of these developments have gradually surrounded my village. When you bring in hundreds of vehicles and thousands of flights associated with changing our lands and waters, it affects our caribou, the fish, the birds.
The administration also announced, along with the Willow approval, a block on new drilling on millions of acres in the National Petroleum Reserve as well as the Arctic Ocean. The Center for Biological Diversity says the Willow Project will add about 260 million metric tons of carbon emissions into the atmosphere over the next 30 years. Supporters of the project say over that same period, the project will produce around 600 million barrels of oil.
You know, this goes to one of the challenges we have in America, which is just how long it takes to get big projects, particularly projects on federal lands, approved.
Alaska Republican Senator Dan Sullivan.
Conoco started acquiring leases for this project, if you can believe it or not, in the late 1990s, Jessica. And we find, and then they do exploration. And by the way, one of the arguments, it's a little technical, but you know, these environmental groups are like, just cancel it. No, you can't do it. Well, you know, this is a private sector company that has paid the federal government hundreds of millions of dollars in leases and rentals to use and get access to the land, right? This is a contract. So anyways, during the Trump administration, they went through a very rigorous, fact-based, science-based environmental impact statement and a record of decision. And it was approved. So every time the Willow Project has gone through an environmental review, it has passed with flying colors. So this was a reapproval, and they limited the project pretty significantly from the approved project during the Trump administration. The Trump administration had approved 5 drilling pads. This project that's been approved by the Biden administration has approved 3. But again, it is still approved by the career staff in the federal government, the scientists. And so, yes, this is not some kind of new project. This has been on the books for about 2 decades.
Well, with getting this through with President Biden, this president who we know has said, you know, no new drilling, how critical do you think it was that the full congressional delegation was on board here? Not just you and Lisa Murkowski, who are Republicans, but your state's new Democratic congresswoman and Alaskan native, Mary Peltola.
It was critical. And I will say that Senator Murkowski and I have been raising this issue since day one with the Biden administration. As a matter of fact, the first meeting I had with the president, with Senator Murkowski and Congressman Don Young, our previous congressman, almost two years ago, it was about tourism, but I brought him a one-pager fact sheet on Willow and kind of turned the topic from tourism to Willow. So we have been pressing him from day one. I do think one thing that also helped is Alaskans were united. I gave my speech to the Alaska legislature. The congressional delegation does an annual speech, and I asked them to come together, Democrats, Republicans, Native, non-Native, elected representatives, and pass a joint resolution, House and Senate, supporting Willow. And it was unanimous. And that's hard to do, as you probably know, in any state. And the first thing I did in the meeting with the president was I handed him that joint resolution, said, Mr. President, here is where Alaskans are, and we are united. And Jessica, the other area that was, I think, surprising to a lot of folks, particularly the radical environmental groups in the lower 48, is the strong, overwhelming support of the Alaska Native community. The lower 48 press loves to say how Alaska Natives are typically against these projects. That's actually very incorrect.
What about the Nooksack folks? They were on board with that lawsuit initially, right? Did they change? Or are they still opposed?
Well, you had
project?
The mayor of Nooksack, who was opposed. And look, on any major project, you always have people who are outliers. And that's her right to speak up against the project. But the vast majority of the different Alaska Native groups, particularly the groups in the North Slope, where this project's going to take place, but throughout the whole state, the Alaska Federation of Natives, which is our biggest Native organization, the collective groups of regional tribes on the North Slope, the North Slope Borough, all of these groups were strongly in favor. And one element that was frustrating is that, you know, you had a lot of people, the far left radicals, both in the Biden administration, the lower 48 radical environmental groups, and the national media that wanted to cancel the voices of the Native people. We brought this up with the president. And, you know, there's a new term in Alaska where our Native leaders are saying, hey, this is the second wave of colonialism. It's eco-colonialism. You have these lower 48 far-left groups who condescendingly tell Alaska Native people who have lived in our great state for thousands and thousands of years, they condescendingly tell them what to do. So the eco-colonialists were trying to kill this project. And to be honest, they're going to continue to try. We're expecting lawsuits from these far-left radical groups any day now. And Alaskans will unite again to fight it. And I think that was one of our strengths when we met with the president to demonstrate to him how united our state was. Very many different diverse groups in Alaska all came together, and that's powerful.
Well, it sounds like you think the answer to my next question is at least in part that support. But why do you think the president signed off on this? Is it just that support, or do you think that, in your mind, do you think the president sees a bigger picture, that this administration sees a bigger picture, and is China involved in that bigger picture and having our own energy, you know, using our own energy sources in this, I guess, international geopolitical climate?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it's the key question. And I will tell you, in our meeting with the president, Senator Murkowski, Congresswoman Pelteau, and I, we put all the arguments on the table, quite forcefully, respectfully, of course. You're in the Oval Office. And so I think it was hard to tell, but the arguments we made varied, right? I said that, for example, this has the highest environmental standards of any energy project in the world, right? Look at the Biden administration's own environmental impact statement actually said that. It called the greenhouse gas emissions from this project, quote, minimal, negligible, and that it was 0.125% of U.S. emissions would come from this. That is literally negligible. It was the strong support from working men and women, 2,500 jobs. Conoco is literally, Jessica, as we speak today, deploying people to start building this, 75% of which are union. You know, the president talks about how he's for working families. Well, this is a great opportunity to show it. And then, as I mentioned, the strong Native support. But to your point, a real strong component of America's national security and America's strength comes from American energy. And the question I posed the president, and I've posed every Biden administration official for the past 2 years, how can you go around the world and beg for oil from dictators from places like Venezuela, where they recently lifted sanctions and now we're importing 100,000 barrels a day, when it's a terrorist regime, Venezuela, horrible environmental standards, way more greenhouse gas emissions from their production processes, and horrible human rights record, a terrorist country, literally, when we could get the energy from America and the revenues would come to us, not to some terrorist regime. And whenever you pose that question, and I've posed it a lot, as you can imagine, including in the Oval Office, with the president, they never have an answer. They don't have an answer. And even the Biden administration's environmental impact statement, the science-based record of decision, said if you don't produce from willow, we will almost certainly get oil from other countries with much worse environmental standards. And that was in their EIS. So I think it was a combination of all these. And I do think we see it all the time. And even on this decision, we saw it. There's a competing factions in this administration, usually the radical enviro faction and their allies in the radical far left environmental group community win out. But even in this decision, I'm sure you saw, Jessica, they announced the Willow Project record of decision. But then they say, but stand by, we're going to shut down millions of additional acres in Alaska. And that was obviously to appease some of these far left groups. And by the way, there's no appeasing them, right? They don't want compromise. They want fully shut down American energy, which, of course, is national security suicide.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the shutting down of the other lands in, I guess, a move, right? So we open the Willow Project up, but we lock up millions of acres for future drilling. It sounds like even if the president or this administration is on board with the Willow Project, this is not an opening for more conversation about other projects like Keystone or anything else, right? I mean, it doesn't sound like this is not the beginning of a shift in this administration or among people who don't want to see additional projects.
Well, I think it just represents, it's a great question. I think it represents this split within the administration and the far left enviros usually have the upper hand. You know, I think if they're going to do future lockups of what's called the National Petroleum Reserve of Alaska, remember, the Willow Project was in what we in Alaska call NPRA, the National Petroleum Reserve of Alaska. It was set aside decades ago for oil and gas development, right? That's the whole purpose of that part of Alaska. So to shut that down and shut down the remaining areas of the outer continental shelf, I think almost certainly will be illegal. We'll see what happens when they actually announce this with some detail. You know, they want to appease these far left groups. As I mentioned, you can't appease them, right? They want a complete shutdown of American energy. But one of the things I did raise with the administration after they told me this was going to happen after, you know, our delegation, the congressional delegation, learned about it in the Washington Post, we weren't even briefed, is that there are millions of acres of leases that are still out in the National Petroleum Reserve of Alaska, in addition to Conoco's leases. And they can't touch those, right? That would be a clear taking. Those are valid existing leases in the NPRA. And by the way, senior Biden administration officials did tell me we won't touch those leases. So those are there. Those are other opportunities that are going to be enhanced now that the Willow Project is happening. But the one thing, another thing I did, I don't think it had much of an impact on the president, but who knows? You never know. During our meeting in the Oval Office, I handed the president this joint resolution from our legislature, but I also handed him a map, and it was called the Last Frontier Lockup, and it depicted the 45 executive orders and executive actions that this administration has taken singularly focused on Alaska. It has locked up every area of our state, every industry, whether it's critical minerals, mining, fishing, hunting, oil and gas. And I gave it to him. I said, Mr. President, respectfully, this is enough. This is unfair. This is wrong that one state, almost all this is driven by lower 48 radical enviros to shut us down. One state should not be bearing the burden of the Biden administration's far left environmental agenda. And we need a ceasefire here. And
well, you know, especially because Alaskans get those permanent fund checks, they're probably like, well,
it's not just the energy, it's access to our lands. It's to be honest, it's why people live in Alaska, the big, beautiful, rugged state. And when you have the federal government saying, sorry, you can't access that, sorry, you can't go there, sorry, you can't utilize these incredible resources that do strongly help us compete against China and Russia. None of it makes sense, but it's very aggravating for Alaskans. And of course, when they do this, it kills jobs by the thousands.
Senator, I know you, just a few more for you, and we'll keep it brief. I know you're anticipating additional legal action, right? I mean, we've heard from Earth Justice. They don't think this fight is over, and they're going to argue what they argued before, which is that the administration isn't fully considering the climate impact here, right? That's at least part of their argument. It sounds like they're ready to keep going to court over the Willow Project. Is this done in your mind now that the administration has approved, or are we in for a delay because of continued court fights?
Oh, Jessica, you're asking exactly the right question, and we are not done. This is just a important battle that was positive. The next battle, which could happen any day, is exactly what you're saying. These radical far-left lower 48 eco-colonialists, I like to call them eco-colonialists because, like I said, they come up, they're condescending as can be to the Alaska Native people, telling them what to do. I mean, it's pathetic. And these people don't care about Alaska. So we're going to get in the arena, battle them. I will be leading a amicus brief of our congressional delegation and other elected leaders, just like we did with the decision with the president, to show that this decision is strongly in the public interest. The state will be involved. I have no doubt that North Slope Borough will be involved. And, you know, the Biden administration will have to defend their record of decision. So we'll all be fighting these lower 48 far left radicals, the eco-colonialists who you want to tell Native people who have been living in Alaska for thousands of years what to do, how to live their lives. And I think the outcome will be different from previous litigation because this EIS that the Biden administration just did was actually designed to address the issues that the court raised the last time.
And EIS, I think the environmental impact.
Correct. Impact, sorry. That's a little bit of jargon here, but the Biden's environmental impact statement, which came out a month ago in this record of decision, these were meant to actually address some of the federal judges' concerns from previous litigation. So you will literally have in this litigation the Native people, the state of Alaska, the congressional delegation and elected officials, the Biden administration, all on one side, and radical far-left eco-colonialists on the other side. And I'm quite confident that the judge will make the right decision and move forward. By the way, the working men and women and the unions that they're in, they're going to be on our side. As I mentioned, they're already heading up to the North Slope as we speak to start building this project. They started to deploy, which is great news, but it shows you just how important this project is, not just for Alaska, but for America. 2,500 direct jobs. The indirect jobs are probably, you know, much, much greater than that.
My last one for you is the CEO of Pioneer Natural Resources says we will never reach a new oil production high ever again. That refining capacity and inventory issues combined mean we're just capped at maybe 13 million barrels a day of production. That was our peak in November of 2019. I know absolutist statements like that almost beg to be tested, but if that's accurate and we're doing this, we're going to have the Willow Project, then realistically, I mean, how much will it, I guess, help the supply if we have all these other constraints in getting oil to market?
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that statement, because in Alaska, we have a pipeline, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, that's two-thirds empty. You know, at peak production, when our country really needed energy during the energy crisis of the 1970s, Alaska was providing 2.1 million barrels a day through that pipeline. That's another one of the real strong environmental aspects of this. We don't need to build out new infrastructure in Alaska. The existing infrastructure can handle not just the max production of 180,000 barrels a day that you're going to see from the Willow Project, but there are a number of state projects that are very close to Willow. There's one called the Pitka Project that's looking at possibly 80 to 100,000 barrels a day for that project. Now, on those kind of projects, we don't need the federal government's permission because it's on state land. So Alaska has enormous resources. I don't agree that we're capped at 13 million. You know, we could easily get up to a million barrels a day with a pipeline that can handle it. We don't need to build any new infrastructure. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline, as I mentioned, is about two-thirds empty. So we have plenty of spare capacity. And the good news is we have enormously prolific areas for not only exploration, but continued conventional oil. That's another reason why the standards in Alaska are so high. We don't have to frack our oil. We still have large conventional pools. We reinject any gas that comes out. So we, again, have these high standards, but we have a lot of capacity. I think Alaska alone could help in bringing this above 13 million. And I think that's a huge area of American strength. Again, I'm all of the above energy, solar, wind, hydro, oil, gas. We need it all. That's my view. But the thing, when you look at the reporting, Putin, Xi Jinping, they look at American energy dominance and it frightens them, especially the Chinese. So why wouldn't we want to continue producing when we have the highest standards in the world? We get the revenues, our great workers get the jobs, and it makes us much more powerful in competing against China and Russia. It's a no-brainer. And I think hopefully that was some of the calculus that went into this Willow decision.
Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan, thanks for joining us here in the lower 48.
Thank you, Jessica. Great to be on the program.
That'll do it for this week's Fox News Rundown from Washington. Next week, President Biden heads to Ottawa, Canada to talk about our shared defense, Ukraine, climate change, supply chains, and more. And Congress holds a number of hearings, including some that will focus on our military posture and readiness. And the CEO of TikTok testifies before the House Energy and Commerce Committee on Thursday. From all of us here at Fox News Radio, thanks for listening. I'm Jessica Rosenthal from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
This is Jimmy Fallon, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.